This is The Guardian.
I'm Laura Murphy Oates, and this is The Full Story.
We literally were sitting on the edge of our seats as we're already full with non-COVID patients, very sick patients requiring quite intensive therapies. And we're like, oh my gosh, it's coming.
This is a senior intensive care nurse. And this summer, the biggest wave of COVID-19 cases that Australia has ever seen hit her hospital.
And it's any time, every time that pager went off, we were like, are they still going to be able to look after on the ward, or do they need to come here? And then pulling more staff to do that.
In January, the record for the deadliest day of the pandemic has been broken repeatedly. And health workers, particularly those on the East Coast, are burnt out and speaking out.
It's literally get whatever nurses you can to try and look after the patients. And it's so unsafe.
Today, a conversation with a paramedic and a nurse on the front line of the Omicron wave. It's Monday, the 24th of January.
My name's Chris Castellan. I am currently State President of the Australian Paramedics Association.
Chris is a paramedic, currently based on the central coast of New South Wales.
And I've been a paramedic for 24 years.
How many of the patients that you're being called out to are COVID patients at the moment?
Yeah, a real lot. I don't know exactly, but certainly on any given day, if you're doing 8 or 10 jobs, I would suggest that anywhere between 5 or 8 of those are COVID positive or suspected COVID positive patients. I think right now this is as busy as we've ever seen it. I think normally we would be averaging around 3,500 cases a day around the state, and around between Christmas and New Year's Eve, we maxed out at 5,200 cases in one 24-hour period around the state. We've seen that the system has shown some cracks.
What do you mean? What are the worst signs of this system cracking that you've heard of?
The paramedics are just doing it extraordinarily tough, both physically and mentally. They're very fatigued and they're doing longer days in the heat of summer and the humidity of summer in full protective, personal protective equipment. And the paramedics are in full PPE for nearly the entire length of their shift, which is a surgical gown, which is really like wearing a large garbage bag. To make sure that you don't get any contaminants on your uniform. You're then wearing an N95 or P2 mask. You're wearing goggles. You're wearing a face shield as well. And you're also wearing surgical gloves.
How many hours, really, do you think people have been working this summer?
You can sign on and you can go straight out the door and you will be out and about for anywhere between 12 to 16 hours. You won't get a break. The best you'll get is to eat a sandwich in the cabin of the car and maybe have a cup of tea and a polystyrene cup and soldier on. I know personally I do quite regularly 14-hour shifts, so 2 hours of overtime, but I know of people consistently doing up to and around 17 hours in a row and being expected to come back the next day to carry on.
In fact, the workload has gotten so great this past summer that Chris says paramedics in metropolitan Sydney are being asked for the first time ever to drive ambulances home at the end of long shifts so they can be on call to head out again.
They've just done a 12 or a 13-hour shift. They're just about to jump in the shower, to have a meal, to spend some time with their family, and then the phone rings again. And then they've got to go straight back out, even though they've done a 12, 13-hour day. And they're out for another 4 or 5 or 6 hours doing multiple calls. Now, these people, they are drunk on fatigue. They are tired. And I'm just not sure whether that's a safe workforce or whether that's sustainable long term.
Yeah, having a paramedic who is drunk on fatigue doesn't sound safe to me.
Yeah, and they feel a real obligation to want to serve the community. And if the phone rings and it's a job that's 2 hours away, you've got to go and do it. The fact that that's happening shows that the rostering or the staffing levels for both metropolitan Sydney and regional New South Wales is just not enough for the workload.
A spokesperson for New South Wales Ambulance confirmed that staff in Sydney metro areas have been offered on-call rostering. They said that on-call shifts were offered in line with the New South Wales Ambulance fatigue policy to ensure staff are provided the opportunity to rest and recover before and at the conclusion of their shift. But Chris says the workload is not allowing people to rest and recover, and some paramedics are experiencing some pretty serious impacts on their physical and mental health.
I've spoken to people who have struggled with sleeping disorders, who end up having gastric upsets, unable to eat, or they have tummy pains or upset. They get headaches, migraines. So it's a very fatigued and psychologically strained workforce during this period of time, particularly the last 2 years. We've really received no extra mental health leave. We've been expected to carry on.
The increased workload is affecting patients too. Over the summer, there was news report after news report about ambulances backed up outside Sydney hospitals for hours, waiting for beds to become available inside. Chris says he saw this issue, known as ramping or bed block, firsthand.
Most of the Sydney metropolitan area has a level of ramping. I've seen pictures and I've been part of areas where there will be 6, 8, 10, a dozen ambulances in an emergency department parking bay with patients in the back for many hours on end. I know in my area up here, not long ago, there was ramping for up to 5 hours before they could offload. But the longest I would have been in bed block this year probably would have been greater than 2 hours. So that's putting significant delays on paramedics' ability to then turn around, clean the vehicle, disinfect, sanitise the vehicle, their personal protective equipment gets changed over, and if we need to have some sustenance or take a convenience break, then to go back out to the community again. And that all puts a strain on our ability to respond in a timely manner.
But it's not just COVID-positive patients who are taking up time. During this latest outbreak, Chris says paramedics have also been called out to help anxious people who aren't in need of emergency help.
A lot of people are just after a little bit of confidence that they're okay. In some instances, we're getting called out and they say, can we do a rapid antigen test? And we actually don't provide that service. Some people have mild shortness of breath, a sore throat, and are similar to other respiratory conditions. So they are easily manageable.
Facing down yet another year of this pandemic, Chris says the wear and tear is starting to chip away at the broader workforce.
We don't have as many people putting their name down to come in and do overtime because they are just so tired physically and psychologically.
Is there anything that could bring down the strain on paramedics and on hospitals right now, in your opinion?
I think we ultimately need to make sure that there's enough paramedics on the road each and every day. We have such a fantastic tap of these university graduates that in the past have struggled to get work locally and have actually headed to the UK or to Queensland or to Victoria. New South Wales Ambulance needs to hire, as soon as possible, another 1,500 paramedics just to bring it into line with other states to make sure that the numbers on the road each and every day are higher to get out to the community and that they are able to fill the gaps of paramedics who need some badly earned time off.
A New South Wales Ambulance spokesperson says that currently 60 graduate paramedics are being inducted and another 200 graduates will begin induction in the coming weeks as they continue to surge their workforce in response to the pandemic. 65 casual paramedics have also been offered full-time employment. How many people do you think have left that you know personally?
I know at least 3 people have left, but anecdotally, I would suggest there's dozens that have left from the area that I'm particularly involved in. Their concern has just been that they've been in the job for a period and that this is the straw that's broken the camel's back. I think paramedics will push through because they have that dedication to the job, but I worry personally how the workforce as a whole, how resilient they're going to be in maybe 6 or 12 or 24 months' time where this all catches up to them.
Now next, a Sydney ICU nurse on the Omicron wave.
Okay, so just a little voice check here, and I had tea and I had toast and I played with my parrot.
In between playing with her parrot and preparing for a night shift, we spoke to Michelle Rosentreter.
I'm a senior ICU nurse in a Sydney Metropolitan Hospital. I've been an intensive care nurse now for 10 years, and I've been a staff rep and union representative for close to 8 years now, and an active member of my Nurses and Midwives Association for 16, 20 years now. For the listeners, it takes about 5 years to train an intensive care nurse. It's a lot of technology that we work with. It's a lot of very dangerous drugs.
Michelle says that this type of training is essential. Nurses in ICU are often delivering life-saving treatment, and their patients are in such severe need that each nurse should only be caring for one to two patients at a time, depending on how sick they are. But that's been put to the test this summer with the Omicron variant.
Well, you see these little trends. I watched going to and from work. I watched the lines at the vaccination hub and the testing clinics get bigger, which indicated to me that people were feeling unwell if they're starting to queue up for a lot more surveillance swabbing.
What is that like when you start to see those signs that you are so aware of now? I mean, how are you feeling about the summer ahead?
Look, it was nerve-wracking, to be honest, because at the same time I saw that trend happening just driving to and from work, the same time I hear our Premier say, nah, you don't need masks. Everybody get out and get on with life and business as usual and businesses need to make money. And I remember thinking, going, please, like, be careful what you're telling people, because there is something else happening and you must be aware. And if I'm aware as a nurse in the system that this is happening. Anyway, he lifted that veil and we quickly got overrun.
Michelle says that a wave of COVID-19 in the community also hits the hospital in waves.
Well, the worst has been seeing what happens in emergency first, as I watched my colleagues in emergency having to treat people in chairs and not beds, where they would rather give them a bed. Slightly longer than the ideal four-hour turnover to try and see a person. And you find out that a person might have been in ED for something like 9 hours. That isn't because the medical teams and the nursing teams down there are being truant in their duties. They just had too much of a volume to deal with.
After emergency fills up, the wave then hits the hospital wards.
On the ward, particularly with Omicron, a lot of the patients are presenting into the ward-based care to begin with. The ward bases are pretty much doubled, if not tripled, their workload. So one nurse to six to seven patients. They may not have primarily come in with a respiratory illness, but Omicron or COVID has then become the forefront of what they need treating for.
And from there, the worst-off patients come to Michelle in the ICU.
Once you start deteriorating, that is that you've now exceeded what the ward level of care can do for you. The ICU team, myself being one of them, will come and attend to you. If you require higher-level care, then you'll be brought to the intensive care. And if we can't manage you with non-invasive techniques to try and stabilise you, we will then induce you and intubate you for ventilation.
As the wave hit ICU, what happened? How did that affect your day, your hours, and what you did each day?
So some of my colleagues are a little bit fitter than myself, so they stepped up and did doubles and did some extra hours.
What's a double?
A double could be 16 to 18 hours, and then you might only get a 10-hour break before returning, or less than a 10-hour break before returning for another shift, because we can't replace you. If you're lucky, you've been managed to get a bit of a break, but our breaks are very short these days and isolated. We don't have breaks together anymore because of the infection risk ourselves. Yeah, lonely little 15 minutes to drink and pee.
Michelle says these breaks are really essential, ICU nurses can't drink water in the ward because of the risk of infection. So just like Chris, the paramedic, she might not drink water for hours. This summer, this issue has been made worse by a lack of staff. Sometimes there just weren't enough nurses in ICU to step in if you needed to leave the bedside for any reason.
You need a lot of hands. If you are looking after a intubated patient who may also be on dialysis, for example, it's heavy work. You need two nurses to check a drug. You need two nurses to check fluids. You might have to run and get that drug. We don't have drug rooms in every single patient room. So we have to leave our patient unattended to go and do that because we didn't have the two nurses. We didn't have somebody to watch. So that equates to managing your patient different to how we prefer to do it. We might have to increase their sedation, for example. We might have to give them a drug that'll paralyze them so they're not at risk while they're not physically being watched by a nurse and treated by a nurse. So chemical sedation, we also do physical restraints as well. We might have to put some little special bracelets and tie you to the bed.
I know these types of chemical and physical restraints have been used throughout the pandemic in some hospitals. It was reported in The Guardian in August last year during the Delta wave. Do you find that tough, using some of these measures?
Yeah, I never thought nursing, I'd spend my time tying down patients. But it is a way to keep the patient safe and to protect their airway while they are so unwell, they cannot comprehend what is going on with them in any case. It's not something we like doing because it will prolong the patient's condition. The heavier we sedate you, the more work we have to do for you, the more pressure and support we have to give you from those machines in order to keep your airways clear.
Michelle says the lack of staff can lead to real harm for some patients.
I mean, we're watching every knuckle, every part of your ear, your chest, your knees, any bony prominence on you. We have to make sure there's nothing digging into you because give it 15 minutes or an hour, if we missed something, even a crease in a sheet can develop into a stage one pressure injury in a matter of weeks if we are not able to reposition you regularly.
And have you seen those types of injuries maybe become more common?
Yes. And that is what breaks our heart. That is not us. That is not what we want at all. We are advocates for our patients, our safe patient care. We like to be able to say, and I still can say, if you're leaving your loved one in my care, they're in safe hands. But it's a challenge, and it's because we don't have enough people and we're overrun with patients.
I hope you don't mind me asking this question and let me know if you're uncomfortable, but did you see many people pass away in ICU?
Yes. It's been a... intensive care, there's never a guarantee that you're going to survive. It's intensive care for a reason. You come into an intensive care because you're critically unwell. You are the sickest patients in the hospital. That's why you need that service. So one of the hardest things that we do as a team, we look at evidence-based research and work with that to what therapies we're providing. And when we see a picture that we feel that the patient won't survive, in the past, we've had time to prepare families for that. It's very hard dealing with a pandemic because some of them like to see the science fail, which means keep doing everything even until they fail and they will die on life support. You can still die if you're on a ventilator. Like when the body's had enough, it's had enough.
We're entering into year three of the pandemic. How have your family and friends felt about you working in ICU throughout this whole time and the risk that it poses to you?
Actually, the change in looking after this infection to any other infection didn't change what we did at home. The risk of me bringing home the bug and being isolated from my family has never been an issue or a concern from work.
Despite Michelle's precautions, she did get COVID in December from her daughter, not from her work. But when Michelle went to take time off, she didn't have any sick leave.
I've run out of sick leave because I suffered burnout earlier in the year, which made me quite unwell.
Michelle says she only gets about 10 days of sick leave a year. In the pandemic, the unions fought for special leave, which is now available for when you get COVID, but only at the discretion of the organisation and on a case-by-case basis.
Well, my director offered me annual leave, but I refused to take annual leave because there was nothing recreational about what I'd just gone through. And I've worked very hard for my annual leave and I wouldn't mind taking a holiday when the opportunity arrives. So, no, I spoke to him and confirmed with our HR department and I did get paid special leave for my absence.
Have you heard of lots of people taking annual leave when they get sick or any people?
Yeah, I know of staff that have taken annual leave. I know staff that have used their, have gone with leave without pay, staff not being compensated. You know, for a bit of an insight, when Delta was on, it was so virulent and so opportunistic that even somebody who was having one of their seasonal allergies, they were furloughed, they were off, and that was leave without pay. So we actually had staff leaving work, like as in not returning to nursing or moving into other areas because they had run out of leave so quickly.
Since Michelle's COVID-19 infection, the New South Wales government has changed isolation rules for healthcare workers. Now, asymptomatic healthcare workers who are considered close contacts are permitted to leave isolation and go back to work. But if symptoms develop, they must test and isolate. Similar rules also exist in states like Queensland and Victoria.
Because they're asymptomatic, they'll wear the mask, the goggles, all the infection control, they're isolated, there's got a special tea room for them now.
Michelle says that at her workplace, she's seen how this policy has led to some nurses who are close contacts turn up to work, become symptomatic, and then test positive for COVID-19.
They might just start to feel a little bit off. They'll do a test and it would turn out that they're positive and they're out.
I mean, from the outside looking in, the idea that the government has created a policy that encourages health workers who may be sick with COVID to come to work doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, what do you think of this policy?
The government's done that because it's a reflection of what's happening inside our healthcare system. We just don't have the workforce anymore. We're all going to get it at some stage. Maybe that's true, but what are you going to do if the people whose sole business and duty is the well-being of others, what are you going to do about their well-being, about the health staff themselves? And the government's got nowhere to move now because we're either off sick with COVID or with burnout or with whatever, or we're working and waiting to get sick. I don't think our federal or state governments have listened carefully to the stories happening overseas and the evidence overseas, and I feel that we could have done a lot better. You rely on the compassion of your healthcare working staff and you use that against us to prop up an inadequate system. So that's my personal view, and I'm happy for that. I'm not talking on behalf of anybody else. I just think that they let us down.
I think we're very grateful that you've given us this time, but also for the work that you're doing this summer. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's it for today. To find out more, check out the articles of Guardian reporter Elias Vasante and economics correspondent Peter Hannam. They've been covering the surge of Omicron cases and the impact this is having on the health system over the summer. We'll put some links to their work on the Full Story page as well. This episode was produced by Jane Lee, Ellen Lee Beater, and Karishma Luthria. Full Story's executive producers are Miles Martignoni, Gabrielle Jackson, and me, Laura Murphy-Oates. Catch you soon.